This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello, welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Are horrific events like Columbine or Newtown preceded by red flags that could have been acted upon to prevent tragedy? Often we hear, "He just snapped." But research shows that warning signs are usually present in youth and young adults leading up to mass shootings. While the majority of children won't experience such atrocities, most will be the victims of some kind of aggression or violence, such as bullying or relational aggression, theft, physical assault, maybe sexual violence, family violence, gun violence, murder, or suicide. Many of us parents worry about our children's safety, and others wonder about what happened in cases of mass shooters. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking about warning signs, particularly how to recognize them and what we can do when we see one to protect our children. We're going to talk about how the old risk factors for victimization and perpetration, things like child abuse and neglect and domestic violence and poverty, have been compounded by new problems, including violent media and kids' entitled attitudes and parents' fear of intervention. And there's also childhood increases of mental illness and disrupted families and substance abuse, bullying, access to weapons, and of course, social media. But when we learn how to recognize the warning signs, we can overcome a lot of those problems.
Hey parents, introducing the Communicizer. Go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
I love you, Dad.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is Lori Bertel, who's the co-author with Brian Johnson of Warning Signs, How to Protect Your Kids from Becoming Victims or Perpetrators of Violence and Aggression. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I want to have you talk a little bit about some history here. I think when we think about warning signs, or we think about things that have gone wrong with children where they've exploded or shot or done terrible things, that there used to be what you call the old risk factors for victimization or perpetration, child abuse and neglect and domestic violence and poverty, things like that seemed simple enough to pin the blame on. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is that it's much more complex now. There's media, there's kids' entitled attitudes, and parents either over, you know, getting over involved with their kids or under involved with their kids. And how has this changed, and over what period of time has this been going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I would say that things are so much different than when I was raised. Our kids, I think in the last 10 years or so, we think growing up has become a lot harder, and parents have been increasingly challenged by new things, like you mentioned, media in particular. I had no idea growing up that you could talk to someone face-to-face on this little screen and be in contact with friends 24/7 and see virtually anything that you wanted to, and sometimes things you didn't want to, on a screen. And that's what our children are growing up with now. And I think it's really hard for parents to keep up with that. And I think it's hard for them also sometimes because they're involved with media a lot too, and that can be kind of distracting or can impede their ability to notice things in their kids and to communicate with their kids. And so I think communication has greatly changed, and not in the best ways, between parents. Although there are great examples of being able to communicate when you didn't used to. I've had patients, I'm in retired OBGYN, but I've had patients actually have their husbands watch from overseas while being deployed, while they delivered their babies, you know, and see their babies right then and talk to their families. And so media isn't all bad.
But, not. But, I mean, you know, and I actually was reading this thing not long ago about how Facebook, I think, and Twitter are running some incredibly complex algorithms to scan tweets and Facebook posts for messaging that might indicate that there's a suicide in the wings. You know, that there, which is, I guess it's that speaks to both sides of it, that there's people are using social media to advertise their intent, whether it's to harm somebody else or themselves, but also that we may be able to use that same technology to help them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, social media can be a very positive thing starting in adolescence as a way for kids to make social connections, especially if they're shy or, you know, they can maybe join a group or have one friend on Facebook and all of a sudden they've got 10. And then when they see those kids at school, they might actually say hi and, you know, start conversations and make connections. And so it's not all bad, but as we know, the information available for kids to see is virtually unlimited and can be extremely harmful psychologically. But I do agree with you that there are ways that kids can, if they're aware and if they're taught what to do when they see certain things, those kids can be very helpful to other kids who are in trouble and who are exhibiting signs of being depressed, of being, you know, feeling overwhelmed or helpless or even being suicidal. But I think it's really great for parents to know kind of how to have those conversations with kids so that they're going to help them recognize when they need to say something to mom and dad to help, or when they, you know, could help themselves by being supportive and that sort of thing.
Well, let's talk about some of those warning signs, since that's the name of the book.
Mm-hmm.
What are some that we should be looking out for that are not necessarily obvious? I mean, certainly we know about if there's going to be a big change in friends all of a sudden, or they're hanging out with the wrong people, or a major change in their fashion choices, or you know, people talk about, you know, if all of a sudden they start wearing really baggy clothes or things with really long sleeves, that may indicate that they're cutting or something.
Cutting, right.
You know, that there are some of the traditional things that I think many people are familiar with. What are some that we might not be quite so aware of, but are just as big and red?
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of depends on which issue we're talking about. In our book, we really talk separately about specific types of aggression, such as bullying, that kids are faced with. And there's a set of warning signs, for instance, that could raise the red flag that, hey, my child is being bullied or seems like they probably are being bullied, and then how to address that. And then there's a separate set of warning signs for when a child might actually be a bully. And then as far as suicide, if that's what you're, you know, interested in, there's a whole set of sort of risk factors. What makes a child more likely to consider harming themselves? And then what are the actual red flags for, hey, this is a serious suicidal adolescent or kid or young adult, and here's what you need to do to act. And so then there's warning signs for just being violent, becoming violent, or actually being some of these folks that have carried out these horrendous attacks that we're all fearing now. And so it depends on which issue you're talking about,
sure,
if that makes sense.
Right. Well, you know, I wasn't even going to ask you that much about this, but you mentioned suicide, and I guess I mentioned suicide also. I just all of a sudden started thinking about when my daughter, who's now starting eighth grade, she was in fifth grade. A girl in her class over the summer, who's 10 years old, killed herself.
Yes.
And my daughter showed me some YouTube videos that this girl had done, and I was looking at those things so carefully, trying to say, oh, there's, you know, oh, yes, you can see that she's, you know, but this kid seemed to be so nice and so self-adjusted and well-adjusted, and I could not see a single thing, and I'm not a trained mental health professional, so that, I mean, some of that might have gone over my head, but there was nothing in there that if I would have said, you know, that I would look back at that and say, oh, boy, I wish I would have known that.
Yes, and boy, wouldn't we like it to be clear every time.
Yeah, right, there should be something that would pop up on the screen that says this is a red flag, but so how do you tell?
Right. And that's an interesting story that you just told, because in one of our blogs we talked about the fact that the fastest growing segment of the population that is committing suicide are young girls aged 10 to 14. Now, that's a small proportion of the total, you know, number who commit suicide, but that is the fastest growing segment, which is incredibly worrisome. And so we postulate about different things. But anyway, you know, I think that sometimes suicidal kids are going to put out those warnings and those flags for I need help, which is when it makes it a lot easier. And then a lot of times, unfortunately, they're not going to show how they're feeling inside. And you've really got to be in touch with that person personally to understand what's going on. And so there are things just like gender. Females are 3 times more likely to attempt it, but males are 4 times more likely to actually complete suicide. Then there's mental illness and substance abuse. And you know, unless you know the person, you know, well, you may not recognize some of the signs of mental illness, especially depression for girls. And there's this whole idea that earlier puberty might be kind of contributing to the depression that is so common in suicidal adolescents and young adults and adults. And so you'd have to kind of know them, but we go into the signs of depression and that sort of thing. Although most people with mental illness don't commit suicide, so, you know, it's not all there. But kids who have a grievance against someone, who have been victimized, like you talked about, you know, it's kind of easy to know that kids who have been abused, you know, are more at risk of harming themselves.
Right.
Access to the means to do it, like firearms and that sort of thing. Family history plays into it, and being impulsive. You know, kids are most likely who go out there and just do things, you know, off the fly, are much more likely to be suicidal than kids who are cautious.
Right.
We were always happy that our daughter was very cautious, you know.
Yeah, I think it's important to add that, I mean, when you talk about much more likely, that these things are still very unlikely to begin with.
Yes.
So, yeah. So
yes,
talking with Lori Birdall, who's the co-author with Brian Johnson of Warning Signs, How to Protect Your Kids from Becoming Victims or Perpetrators of Violence and Aggression. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Lori.
Check it out. It's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, talking with Lori Birdall, who's the co-author of Warning Signs, How to Protect Your Kids from Becoming Victims or Perpetrators of Violence and Aggression. And I think I would guess, you tell me if I'm wrong, that one of the biggest blind spots in parenting is my child is a potential perpetrator of something.
Yeah.
I think that we don't want to see it. And in some cases, it's because we are doing that same behavior anyway, and our kids are getting it from us, which makes us even less likely to see it.
Yes.
But, I mean, how do you get to a point where you can train yourself to be a little bit more objective and say, this is just not right. And what you, you were talking about, somebody who's been bullied is much more likely to then become somebody who picks up a gun and decides to solve problems that way.
Yes, yes. And that's a great question, too. And I think the same thing can be said for trying to put the blinders on when your child could be victimized, because that's a scary thing. And I think on both sides, wondering if your child is being a victim of something or could become a perpetrator, I think it's so scary sometimes that parents would rather kind of wish it away and or wait for something really bad to happen, or even if things are happening that don't seem right, sometimes it's just such a scary thing that they'd rather just wish it away. But what we try to do is emphasize that taking action and actually, you know, doing something is going to be a lot less scary. I'll give you an example. A lot of kids, we were just talking about suicide, and a lot of times you'll have to be talking to a parent who's worried about their child, and you say, hey, you know, are you worried about them harming themselves? And they say yes, and then you say, well, you know, you really need to ask them, you know. Well, then they say, well, I don't know what I would do if they said yes. You know, like that's scarier than actually just asking. But when you have the information and you know what to do with those yes answers, then that puts you in control, and that feels so much better. And if you're not sure if you should be concerned about something, and we try to make this really clear in the book about all these different types of aggression and violence faced by youth, if you're not sure, ask someone else. Hey, this is what I'm seeing. What do you think? You know, a sibling or a teacher or, you know, a spouse or a parenting partner or whatever. Because sometimes it is hard to be objective with your own children, but somebody else, even a neighbor, you know, would say, oh, boy, I'd worry about that, you know. So that's one way that you can be more objective.
You never want to be the one who says, nah, don't worry about it. And
yeah,
then
right.
Something happens.
Well, sometimes you can, though, because, you know, there are parents who are kind of like too involved sometimes and watching a little too closely. And we talk about that a little bit. You know, how do you know when you're kind of being intrusive and worrying too much when really your child is just spreading their wings and, you know, trying to gain autonomy and make their own decisions? And so sometimes, you know, parents do need to hear, you know what, my kid was just like that, and so was my nephew, and, you know, I didn't worry about it. You know what I mean?
You know, this reminds me of my oldest daughter, who's now 25. She, when she was in high school, was doing a volunteer project with some with a shelter for kids who've been sexually abused.
Oh, that's great. Wow.
And she's an artist, and so she was doing kind of not art therapy because she's not a therapist, but she was doing a lot of art with them.
Yeah.
And she came home with a bunch of drawings, and we were looking at them, and I started looking them up in different textbooks, you know, mental health textbooks, and you know, you go online or you look in the books, and there's like, if you see a child has drawn a picture of somebody with a face, that means that they've been sexually abused. If they draw a picture of somebody without a face, it means that they're sexually abused. You know, there's so many different things, and I remember just the thing that popped into my mind then was a Freud quote, you know, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Mm-hmm, that's
and,
right.
You know, it's kind of what you're talking about is that you can see whatever you're inclined to see in anything. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, how do you, we were talking about how do you not miss signs, but how do you not go overboard and add all sorts of unsavory, you know, meanings to things that are possibly completely innocuous?
Right. And you, when you overreact, then you can impact the relationship with your child, which is the number one way to prevent children from becoming victims and perpetrators. And so
is what? Say that again, the number one way.
Yeah, having a good, close relationship with children as a parent is the number one way to prevent becoming victims and perpetrators of violence and aggression. That relationship really is more important than discipline. It really is, actually, because discipline and guiding your children and monitoring their activities is so important also to protecting them. But those things are going to fall short if you don't have that relationship. For instance, if, you know, we're talking about warning signs, and by the way, another thing that you want to, I think, look at is how many warning signs are we seeing? Is it just one, you know, because in our lists of warning signs for a particular issue, you know, you can overreact if you're just seeing one thing and everything else seems to be okay and you've got that relationship and you feel like, you know, they're communicating with you okay, you don't see anything else going on, then, you know, you're all right. So that's another way to do it. But if you don't have that relationship, kids are very unlikely to open up and voluntarily tell parents what's going on in their lives and what they're upset about or what they worry about or, you know, that they might be in a dangerous spot and they want you to know. So when you have that good relationship, they're going to much more likely voluntarily just tell you without having to grill them or ask them or bug them, you know. And so that really helps you know, and it really helps them listen to what parents have to say and to their advice.
How do you, as a parent, if, for example, if you have a, you see your child is hanging out with unsavory characters, how do you not push the boundaries of the relationship that you have? Because, I mean, in some cases, conversations with parents are fine, but in other cases, there's certainly with teenagers the natural, whatever my parents say, I'm going to turn around and do exactly the opposite.
Right.
And
right.
So you could come down too hard and push your child in the opposite direction.
Right. And that speaks to what we were just saying, that hopefully all throughout your parenting time with your kids, you have built and maintained that relationship so that they really believe that what we do is in their best interest, that we're doing things because we care, not because we want to control. And as far as those perilous friendships, you know, that you feel like, gosh, my kid really shouldn't be hanging out with this kid, and we try to distinguish between, you know, where's the boundary where, you know, you've got to do something because this is, even if your kid is mad at you, you got to do it. But when you explain why you do things and you've got that relationship to back up, you know, that you're doing something out of concern, you can make that happen. But in general, with perilous friends you feel like there's some danger with, you want to very gradually chat in a way that helps them realize that they're really going to lose out on other better relationships and they're really going to potentially be, you know, not so happy that they spent time with this kiddo. So that you're kind of giving them little bits of information over time so that they can decide themselves, or they feel like they've decided themselves that, hey, you know, there are better people to hang out with.
You know, Laura, we only have just a minute left, but I want to have you quickly take a crack at this. No matter what we do, there's going to be some kids who are going to do things that they shouldn't do.
Yes.
How do you decide, you know, when it's beyond your capabilities and you need to report something to the police or to some other kind of an authority?
Yeah. The two most obvious are communications that indicate a plan to attack a place or people, and that would be in writings and online postings, saying things to kids at school or at work. And so that's, you know, number one. And the more detailed the plan, the more concern there is, but especially if someone is in possession of weapons, and particularly with recent acquisition of weapons or some kind of basically always into weapons and studying about them and learning about them, including bomb making and that sort of thing. So those are the two most obvious signs you need to call law enforcement.
Yeah.
And even if you're wrong, it doesn't matter. You know, the thing is, we need to be reporting those things because those are the two most common threads that really did indicate a danger.
Lori Birdall, the co-author with Brian Johnson of Warning Signs, How to Protect Your Kids from Becoming Victims or Perpetrators of Violence and Aggression. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Armin. I appreciate it.
Hands can do incredible things. This is the sound of two hands helping to save a life. It's called hands-only CPR, and it's recommended by the American Heart Association. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. Hands can do incredible things, but nothing compares to using them to help save a life. For more information on this latest method of CPR, visit handsonlycpr.org today. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
Hey there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Let's talk toys for just a little bit here. You know, with all the camps and family trips and excursions and nonstop activities, after a couple of weeks, summer vacation can sometimes start to feel like real work. Well, here are some great ways to slow things down and get back to having some good old-fashioned, low-pressure fun. Math Dice Chase from Think Fun. Think Hot Potato, but with math facts. This game comes with two pairs of 12-sided dice, and the goal is to pass your pair to your opponent before he or she does the same to you. The way you get rid of your dice is by rolling them, multiplying the two up-facing numbers, and calling out your answer. The speed factor and the element of competition make Math Dice Chase a fun, engaging way for kids and adults to master their multiplication tables. There are, of course, plenty of other ways to use the dice. You might, for example, roll one and have three players roll a die of their own and be the first to multiply theirs by the one in the middle. Ages 8 and up retails for about $6.99, and you can get more information at thinkfun.com. Escape the Room, Mystery at the Stargazer's Manor, from Think Fun. There's something very strange going on at the old manor down the street. Your neighbor, a famous astronomer, has seemingly disappeared, and you and your guests have decided to investigate. Being adventurers, you let yourself into the astronomer's house, but gasp, you find yourself locked in a room, and time is running out. The only way you'll survive the night, why do these things always happen at night, is to work together using logic and problem-solving skills to solve puzzles and unlock clues. It's a delightful but a little sinister way to spend time with your family and or friends. The kit includes scene cards, sealed envelopes containing secret items. No, we're not going to tell you what they are. Instructions and more. It's for 3 to 8 players, ages 10 and up, and retails for under $22. You can get more information at thinkfun.com. Backspin from Think Fun. Imagine a two-sided flying saucer with 6 color-coded slots on each side. Every slot can accommodate 3 colored marbles for a total of 36, but there are only 35 marbles. That allows you to push a marble from one side into the empty space on the other. Mixing everything up is plenty of fun and involves lots of twisting and spinning and poking, but the real challenge is getting all the marbles back into their original positions. Backspin is frustrating in a good way and requires logic, planning, time, and patience. But it's also incredibly addictive, and you won't want to put it down. It's for one player, age 8 and up, so it's perfect for when you need a little me time, and retails for about $14.99. More info at thinkfun.com. Wet Head from Zing. If you're looking for a fun way to cool down after a long day out in the sun, Wet Head is perfect. Imagine a small tank that's mounted on what looks like a hard hat. The tank has 8 pins sticking out of it. Then you fill the tank with water and put the hat on. One of those pins will dump the contents of the tank onto your head. Now, you spin the spinner, and that's going to tell you what to do, to pull one or two pins, skip a turn, or do something else. There's also a Wet Head Challenge app that brings in trivia questions and just adds to the fun factor. If you follow the instructions and stay dry, you pass the hat to the next player. Eventually, someone's going to get soaked. You can play outdoors or indoors, fully dressed or clothing optional. It's for ages 4 and up, retails for about $20. You can find out more at wethead.toys. For more information on these toys and a lot of other toys and games that we've reviewed over the years, please take a look at our website, parentsatplay.com. We'll be back next week with another Parents at Play segment or an Ask Mr. Dad segment. But don't go quite yet, because we will be right back with more Positive Parenting.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Looking for the best all-you-can-eat buffet for only $1.99? Come to Big Ed's Chow House. But if you're looking for Big Ed, don't come to Big Ed's Chow House. Big Ed passed away last week at 47, leaving his wife and children struck down in his prime by the same disease that got his father, so he won't be around for his family. And sadly, it could have been detected early with a simple test, but Big Ed didn't get it.
Have you gotten the medical test you need? For a list of tests every man should have, go to AHRQ.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hello and welcome to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. When Rosalind Wiseman first published her book, Queen Bees and Wannabes, she changed the way adults look at girls' friendships and conflicts, how they choose their best friends, and how they express their anger, and how they relate to boys and parents. We had Rosalind on the show back then, and we've had her on a couple times since then, and now she's done a tremendous amount of original research and has got a new group of teen editors, and she's come up with a revised and updated edition of this groundbreaking book. It's the third edition, and she talks a lot about how girl world has fundamentally changed in recent years. She's got a lot of great information about how girls are interacting with the world of social networks and video games, how early puberty is impacting girls' social development, and how they can, and their parents, of course, can deal with cyberbullying. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with Rosalind Wiseman about the new book and how girl world has changed since the last time we had her on the show, and there have been a lot of changes. One of our first orders of business is going to be to crack the girl code so we can understand the powerful role that cliques play in shaping every aspect of adolescent girls' lives. The goal here for today's show is to give you some concrete strategies that are going to help you empower your daughter to be socially competent and treat herself with dignity. And when I say you, I actually mean us, because I've got three daughters and I'm talking to moms and dads. We'll jump right in after this.
You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Remember that 4'9" is the magic number, and get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Oh, thank you.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and talking with Rosalind Wiseman, who's the author of Queen Bees and Wannabes, Helping Your Daughter Survive Cliques, Gossip, Boys, and the New Realities of Girl World. This is the third edition, if you can imagine that, the book that inspired the movie Mean Girls. Rosalind, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back again.
Well, it's always a pleasure. So what has changed? I mean, that's obviously the topic of the entire conversation that we're going to be having here. But what's changed in the last, since the last edition, say 4 or 5 years ago?
Well, a whole new generation of social media is probably the most obvious and the most the issue that parents are constantly trying to figure out and how to catch up on and how to be as responsible as possible in guiding their daughters. But there's so many consequences and sort of things that come from that. So I think that social media is probably the biggest issue. But connected to that also is that it was really important for me to talk about girls and brain development and younger girls, because people seem to be very focused on girls' aggression getting younger. So I wanted to address that even more than I did in the second edition.
You said girls' aggression?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Younger girls' aggression. I get a lot of emails and people coming up to me saying, it's starting so much earlier. I see it in kindergarten. And that has become increasingly common for parents and for teachers to be talking to me about. So I wanted to address that even more in this edition.
Let's talk about that right now, actually, because I'm very curious about that. I saw that in the book and was looking at those pieces. But what type of aggression are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about things that we characteristically think of as teen behavior, where girls who are 5 and 6 and 7 years old are verbally aggressive, are unfortunately good at being really social isolating to other kids or exclusive, or are also taking the things that they see from teenagers and in the way that they talk and the way that they dress and the way that they interact with adults is more sort of stereotypical in negative behavior that we see with teenagers. And parents and educators are talking to me about interacting with younger kids more and more that way. And they really don't know what to do. They're so shocked by it that they don't know what to do. Or one of the more common things that parents will do in those situations is they will go and scream at the kid who's being mean. But the kid who's being mean, you know, you laugh, right? The kid who's being mean does not ever, I've never heard a kid express to me when it happened to them at 6, and they might be 10 now or 15 or whatever. But I've never had a girl say to me that, yeah, this mom came up to me and started screaming at me about how mean I was, and I absolutely realized it, and I stopped right away. When girls have parents come up and scream at them, especially in public, they just get really defensive, and then they hate that mother.
I guess that makes perfectly good sense. I mean, from the point of view of a teenager, or from the point of view of anybody. I mean, anybody. Somebody comes up and screams at you, you're going to probably, your instinctive reaction is going to be just to smack them. But
and moms will say, you know, people will say to me, they go up to girls sort of defiantly, and you know, and they will say, "Don't you realize how mean you're being? And you're such a mean girl." And really, the reaction, especially from the girl's development of where she is right now, is that she looks at the person who's yelling at her and says, "I'm not being mean. I was just sitting here. You're the one that's being really mean. You're the adult. You're the one that's screaming at me. Like, I'm not doing anything." And that's what they see. So they don't. It doesn't tend to be a moment of self-reflection. Say it that way.
So are you talking about physical aggression here, or is this mostly kind of the stereotypical girls, as you said, isolating each other or just being nasty?
Yes, and not just girls, too. I mean, the girls can be really aggressive to boys as well. But so what was really interesting was that I asked this generation of teenagers, when was the first time that you remember these kinds of things happening to you, or being somehow mixed up in or on the receiving end or the perpetrating end of being mean to somebody, and in the ways that we talk about in Queen Bees. And the girls truly talked across the board that their first experiences and recollections, like strong memories of it, were at 6 and 7 years of age.
You know, I'm curious about the interactions with boys, the aggressive interactions with boys, and how much all of this may have to do with this movement over the past 5-10 years or so that's really kind of geared up to a frenzied pitch of girl power and girls rule, boys drool, that kind of thing. And there is almost a sense that as a girl, you can do whatever you want to whomever you want, and it's okay because you're taking back
your
power.
Well, you know who really believes that? Right, you know who really believes that? Who really, really, really believes that are middle school boys. And elementary school boys. They really feel that they are always getting into trouble. There's always hyperbole. So the boys, when you talk to boys in elementary school and middle school, they'll say, "We always get in trouble, and girls never get in trouble, and girls are way worse than we are." And that's across the board wherever I go. Boys are adamant. They are 100% adamant that that is the case. I think what's important for us as adults is that we don't get confused about something. It's really important that girls have high self-esteem, but that high self-esteem is based on what Joanne Deak talks about competency, confidence, and connectedness in equal measure. So you are connected to people meaning that you feel a responsibility basically to be decent to them is one way that I look at it and talk to young people about. So we have to be really careful that we are not so focused on girls sort of taking over the world that we forget that they have to be decent human beings at the same time, and that their rights are not more important than other people's. And so that, for some segment of parents that I work with, you can see that. You can see that they say, like, I'd rather have
you know, a ball buster or somebody who runs over people than somebody who's passive and a pleaser. And both really have challenges, significant challenges. And so it's really important that we think about that we are wanting girls to be strong without taking away their sense of responsibility to other people.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great message right there, is not taking away the sense of responsibility that you can't do whatever you want in isolation because you're affecting other people.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. And now at the same time, though, it is true that by at least late, like elementary school, that, you know, fourth and fifth grade level, that girls are dealing with some boys who can be sexually aggressive to them or really disrespectful to them and using gendered language to go after the girls, and the girls getting really frustrated and not knowing what to do about it. So what I see in the elementary and middle school, which of course I see sort of in different forms in high school because I work with all age range of kids, is that there's a couple of boys who do that, and the girls get really, really frustrated at them. But then there's other boys who don't have as much social power or not going to do the things that I was just talking about with that former group of boys. And they can be, some boys can be really easily manipulated by girls. And that's a totally different personality type. But it doesn't cancel out the reality of both, right? The girls are dealing with some boys who can be really, there's always the pervert, right? There's always the pervert. And the other boys won't say anything about it, and they won't stand up to him. And
sure.
And so there's always that, and then there's always the boys who can be easily manipulated.
Well, and there's also the, I guess you could call it the pervert girl who's maybe a little bit more sexually precocious, who's kind of making fun of boys who are not anywhere near where she is maturity-wise.
Oh, sure.
I mean, you know,
sure.
These young boys feel that they're getting picked on that way. They don't know, you know we're supposed to say yes all the time or supposed to always want it, and there's a big percentage of young boys who just aren't ready, physically 100%. Or otherwise.
Yes, and I absolutely, and then you add on, which really tends to, when I talk about this in presentations with parents, really ups their anxiety, but it's true that puberty is happening so much faster for girls, and that in my experience working with girls for as long as I have, that in general what you have when girls go through puberty earlier, and we have a good percentage of girls who are starting breastfeeding at the age of 8 across socioeconomic lines that and race and ethnicity lines, that when you have that, as girls get into that 9, 10 years of age, 11, 12 years of age, that what we see is that girls either have one or two reactions to it. One is they, you know, put on a big sweatshirt and they round their shoulders so that nobody can see what's happening to their bodies. Or they tend to have the opposite reaction, which is, I'm going to, like, sort of take this out for a test drive, and I'm going to show this to everybody, and I'm going to interact with people, like, that this body is the first thing that you're going to think about me. And those girls, and research really is backing this up, that those girls tend to interact with kids that are older than they are. And that means that when they do that, they tend to get into situations that are older and really inappropriate for them. It's a complicated issue. The stuff about early puberty, starting earlier, has a lot of social implications that I think we often don't think about.
Talking with Rosalind Wiseman, who's the author of Queen Bees and Wannabes, Helping Your Daughter Survive Cliques, Gossip, Boys, and the New Realities of Girl World. It's the third edition. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Rosalind.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom. You see me around the neighborhood, and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid. Well, I'm one out of every 5 children in America, and I'm struggling with hunger.
Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me.
We are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Broad. If you're just joining us, talking with Rosalind Wiseman, who's the author of The Queen Bees and Wannabes, Helping Your Daughter Survive Cliques, Gossip, Boys, and the New Realities of Girl World. Let's just jump in right where we left off, because I wanted to ask. I've been writing down little notes here on a piece of paper as you're talking, and one that I've got circled a few times is why. Why is this happening? I mean, and some of it we can write off and say, okay, that's just Mother Nature or Father Nature or whoever it is that's governing nature these days, with early puberty. But that can't be all of it. There's got to be something else. Is there? I mean, social media plays in there. Is just the regular media like TV and movies? How is this all coming together to create this complete upheaval in what's going on with girls?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a combination of, as you're saying, it's a combination of all of these things that we've always dealt with. Like, for example, we have always, as human beings, wanted to be in groups, and there is nothing wrong with that. We do wonderful things sometimes when we are operating in groups. And we've always, for as long as there have been human beings, we get a sense of ourselves and a sense of wanting to be on this world by our connections with other people. And that is a drive for us. It is also a drive in the way our brains work to label people and label ourselves and to create hierarchies. And the way I say it to the kids I work with is that I want the hierarchies based on merit, on what you've done and on how you behave, not just because, for example, you're at a particular age. Because if you're 15 or 16 years old, or with my seniors, my high school seniors, that when they say, well, we're seniors, so we get to act the way, we get to do what people did to us when we were freshmen. I disagree with that, and I challenge that a lot, about hierarchy should be based on the merits of how somebody conducts themselves. And you just don't get status, you should earn it. And I think what's really important is that we've got all of these different attributes that you've talked about just getting more and more heightened and more feeling like there's no place to escape or to look at yourself in a different way, to see yourself outside of the labels that you might have put on yourself or other people have put on you or outside of the group that you've associated with. I think we have less, in some ways, we have less ways to get away from that for a lot of kids. And so they feel more and more trapped in the identity that they have, and they have to follow. And it's even more that they have to follow the group. And keep in mind, of course, that this is actually literally what their brains are doing right now, is that they get a lot of reward from being in a group. So physiological reward. So there's so much drive to these things, and it also is exacerbated by the constant feeding of it from the things you're talking about, from social media, from parents, frankly, who are hyper focused on, having their children be successful and happy. And what that means to them is that they have the best grades and the best this and the best that, and they're going to go do this and this, and it's all going to be a success. And I don't even know how people can stay sane that way. So it's not just about social media, yeah. Right? It's about parents like completely losing their minds about, what does it really mean to have a happy life and to have kids that you can be proud of?
Yeah, that's a huge issue. I mean, how much of it is their accomplishment and how much of it is that we think that their accomplishments somehow reflect on our parenting or ourselves as individuals, It's hard. It's hard to separate that out.
It's really hard. And, it's funny because, it's really funny because people love to say to young people all the time now, because it's brain development stuff, they love to say, your brains aren't developed until you're 25. Well, then I need to tell parents, then what's your excuse for acting so immaturely? Like, what is your excuse for, constantly curating these perfect images on Facebook and seeing how many likes you get? And, pretending to everybody that we have these perfect lives when we really don't. And Or why can't we see? Why do we struggle so much that our own addiction to social media really takes away from our credibility to say to our kids, put the phone down? So it's really tough. We can be really challenged to look at how we are contributing to the behavior or that we don't have a lot of credibility when we're talking to our kids about these issues.
Do you think, on a completely different topic, that some of this behavior, the gossiping and the maneuvering that goes on, the mean girl kind of stuff, that there's some sort of biological reason why that exists? I mean, in terms of human development,
sure.
Is there some, going like back, 10,000 years,
yeah,
or something, is there,
sure,
some reason?
Sure. Well, I'm a big proponent of nature and nurture and culture, actually. But and having all of those these things are always part of who we are. And so, sure, that competitive, you know, behavior between girls about relationships or about resources, if you look at it as from a resource standpoint, that, you know, for as long as human beings have been around, there's been a, you know, there's a drive to collect resources and to be safe, to be physically and emotionally safe, to feel like you are in the right spot, that you're not going to be eaten, that you are in the right spot, and that you have enough things to take care of yourself. And that has translated in a lot of interesting ways as we've developed, so that what does it mean for a girl to be safe? I'm not talking about physical safety, which is a significant issue. I'm talking about emotional safety, about feeling like I need to have as many friends around me as possible to feel that I'm safe in this world. Or feeling like if a girl, you know, stops being my friend and there's like a breakup, that it feels like a tremendous loss. And that's about how, from our very beginnings, like how important relationships were for us, and going back to how important it is for us biologically and our brains to be connected to people. And then that really then very much dovetails and very much or integrates into our into how we're nurtured and then the culture that we live in. So for me, it's all about the integration. But of course, biology is always there interacting with these two other forces.
You know, all of these things, again, are coming together. How much of it overall has to do with sex? I mean, not biology,
like
sex, but wanting it or not wanting it, or wanting other people to think that you're having it, plenty of it, or wanting to use it as a weapon, or, you know, whatever. It just seems to be so much more a presence in, you know, I can't even figure out exactly what age, but I find myself thinking as I'm reading a lot of this stuff and things that are out there generally about girls in particular, think, boy, that was not going on when I was in middle school.
You know, no, and there was no access, right? I mean, so that's why I have to write these. I have to write these editions like every 5 years, because 5 years ago, when I wrote the second edition, girls for the most part were not sending, like, you know, bra pictures of themselves in bras, or nude pictures,
or less,
semi-nude, or, you know, and boys weren't doing it, and they weren't sending it. I mean, like 5 years ago, that was really not that common. Now it is, frankly. You know, it's common. It doesn't mean that your daughter is necessarily doing it, but it does mean that kids are not like, oh my gosh, I've never seen that before. And unfortunately, it's like, it's, you know, in middle school, it's in some ways it feels to me like it's become a rite of passage of like when you receive your first naked picture, or when you find out that like somebody is like, you know, there's a rumor around school, or you see the picture, you know, if it's not on Snapchat, that you actually see the picture and it doesn't just go away. That, you know, this has become incredibly common. And even if you aren't like the initial recipient of it, you're hearing about it. So it impacts the culture of the school and of your experience in school. So that sexualizes the school day. And that's different. And you know just as well as I do that the first, you know, onset of seeing pornography is around 11 for both boys and girls. So that's different. And there's, you know, it's that thing of kids being curious about their sexuality and they're developing physical bodies, which there's nothing wrong with, and having access to the worst explanations of that and not knowing how to process it and not wanting to talk to your parents about it because you're worried that they're going to buy some kind of spy software and take away your phone. So you don't say anything. Or somehow your mom finds out that you've seen this stuff, and then they blame the kid that your parent doesn't like for, like, you know, influencing you in a bad way.
Yeah.
Right? So there's so many ways in which young people don't want to talk to their parents about it, yet they have access to this stuff. So I think that, sure, I think that the world is a lot more sexual place, and I struggle with that a lot as a mom myself. I struggle with it as a teacher. When I have my students come to me and talk to me about this, I struggle as a parent when my now rising eighth grader just broke up with his girlfriend a couple months ago and got pictures from girls. And, you know, that really blew me away. Totally, you know, the expert that I am was completely at a loss for words for a little while.
Well, girls are auditioning. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. All right. Rosalind Wiseman is the author of Queen Bees and Wannabes, Helping Your Daughter Survive Cliques, Gossip, Boys, and the New Realities of Girl World. Rosalind, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it is always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.